From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, continuing our look at Michiganders wrongly convicted of crimes they didn't commit.
You only realize it happens when it happens to you or someone close to you. I had no idea innocent people went to jail until I was the innocent person in jail.
Plus, Ken Burns previews his newest film, The Vietnam War.
We caught some virus back then, a kind of virus of disunion and separatism that we experience today. The disease has only gotten worse.
Northern Michigan University, the first in the nation to offer a degree in medicinal plant chemistry.
Commercial cannabis is becoming a very large industry, so there's a lot of sense that there's going to be growth in the industry.
And John Eubank, and what do you really think of NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman?
Dumb, dumb, and dumber.
But first, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is a big week for the future of mental health care in Michigan. All the complexities aside, which we have covered at length on Stateside over the past year, essentially it comes down to one question. Should the mental health services remain in control of public entities like community mental health centers, or should private insurance companies take the lead? At stake is nearly $2.5 billion a year in Medicaid funds and the services for more than 350,000 Michiganders who are receiving care for severe and persistent mental illnesses. Now, virtually everyone agrees the system can be improved, and integrating mental health care with physical health care would both reduce costs and improve services. The health plans say they can do it more efficiently and effectively. The advocates say patients and their families overwhelmingly want it to stay in the public's hands, and that the health plan's financial incentives don't align with caring for our most vulnerable citizens. Legislators will announce their budget proposal for the Department of Health and Human Services this week, and it'll include just which way they want things to go. With us now is John Lindstrom, publisher of Gongwer News Service, and he's been following this in the legislature. John, it's the House Appropriations Health and Human Services Subcommittee that gets the first say on this, led by Representative Edward Canfield. He's a Republican from Sebewaing. What's he saying so far?
Not a thing. He is keeping this as tight to the vest as I've seen few other things. Everyone understands the controversy involved in this. To be actually technical, the Senate subcommittee is going to meet on Tuesday, but they've already said whatever we do is going to be nothing compared to whatever the House does. But they don't know either at this point. We've not been able to track down a single source who knows and will say definitely what it is the subcommittee on the House side is considering for this program.
And as you're saying, Senate is kind of sounds like it's getting out of the way of the House.
I think they want to see what the House is going to propose and what therefore might get through at least the Appropriations Committee and then move from there. And the governor's office has been rather circumspect on this. Obviously, Lieutenant Governor Calley played a major role in trying to get some agreement on principles, at least, of what should be considered as they move towards some sort of a consolidation or coordination system for Medicaid payments between both mental health and physical health. But they have not come out at this point and directly said what it is they would like or whether or not they're involved with the House subcommittee in coming up with their proposal.
So it sounds like everybody in the Capitol is tight-lipped. What about when you talk to advocates of the mental health care community? What are you hearing? What worries them the most?
Well, you talk to the advocates, and quite a number of them will say that at some point a type of coordination would make sense because, of course, these are patients who not only get Medicaid for mental health reasons, but they also, many of them, get Medicaid for physical health reasons, and there are very often a lot of physical health problems that some of these folks suffer with as well. What they are most concerned about, though, is making sure that the patients get the kinds of treatment that they need and that treatment is based solely on what is best for the patient as opposed to what might be the most cost-effective, which I suppose in theory could also be the best thing. But they want to make sure that the best treatment is the first priority, and then you move from that point. And they are very concerned that if you set up a system that coordinates benefit payments through a single entity, such as the HMOs, which have done a very, very good job in terms of coordinating and providing care for physical patients under Medicaid, and there's been a lot of surveys and research that finds that physical health patients are relatively satisfied with the treatment and the care they get, that won't be the first priority, that it will in fact be more cost-focused and cost-conscious as opposed to treatment-focused.
How could the House Republican effort to cut individual income taxes factor into all of this?
Well, it could factor, and to what degree, that's another thing we're still not quite certain of. We do know that the DHHS budget that the subcommittee will propose will be somewhat smaller than what the governor has proposed. We don't know specifically that the Section 298 provision, which is what we've been talking about, will be significantly smaller. The governor didn't really put a lot of money into that specific section, but it could play a role. I mean, obviously, if you're looking at, for House Republican side, if you're looking for a way of finding a way to cut the income tax, you've got to find a way, therefore, to cut expenses. And if you can find things that will cost less in the long run, such as possibly coordinating payments for mental and physical health, then that's something that they're going to consider. We have to remember that Representative Canfield is a physician. One presumes he is thinking about what would be good for patients as well as what would be good for the state coffers.
So, John, what comes after this week's budget announcements? What do we watch for?
We still have some time left before there's a final decision on this, but the legislature and the governor would like to see the budget completed by the beginning of June. There's been some talk that we may go too close to mid-June, but most people think June 1 is the actual drop-dead date that they're trying to get the budget done by. So by some time, we're not talking eons. We're talking weeks at most before there's a decision of some sort.
John Lindstrom, publisher of Gangwer News Service. John, thanks so much for speaking with us and filling us in.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And we have to talk about this. I've got the hockey guy right in front of me. And that decision from the NHL saying we are not taking part in the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in Seoul, which seems to close a 20-year chapter on NHL players skating at the Olympics. What's going on here?
Dumb, and dumber. How about that?
How about that?
Gary Bettman is the dumbest commissioner I've ever seen, period.
Tell us how you feel, John.
Well, likeable guy. I've talked to him.
Is he getting it from owners who say, I don't want my schedule messed up?
He's a shill for the owners, but the owners are always small-minded. The owners are always short-sighted. It takes an NFL commissioner like Pete Rozelle in the 60s and 70s to get them to align, to realize if we all work together, prisoner's dilemma.
To herd cats.
If we all herd cats, if we all get together, we'll make more money in the long run together if we share our resources and whatnot. And the NFL gets that now in a big way. The NHL is still dumb. Look, they were begging to get in the Winter Olympics, the NHL players, the pros, a la the Dream Team in the NBA, 20-some years ago.
Yep.
Why? Because you make the game more international. You sell more skates. You sell more jerseys. You get more kids playing all over the world. And now they're the ones pulling out of the Olympics. The Olympics should say, see you later, don't come back at that point. You can't just turn it on and turn it off, I would say, if I'm the IOC. This is so stupid. And the argument is, well, not many people play hockey in Asia. Right. Exactly. You're not going to sell hockey anymore to Canadians. They've already bought the game. It's their game. They're buying all they can. Holy mackerel, you got a chance to sell China. Don't forget how the NBA was dying to get to the Beijing Olympics in 2008. David Stern, one of the smartest commissioners in the history of sports, NBA commissioner, he realized they can buy a lot of Nike, a lot of Adidas, a lot of jerseys, and that's what they did. So this is immensely stupid.
And then for players, the question is to go or not to go. And I know immediately Russian superstar Alex Ovechkin was very clear. I am going, to quote him, somebody going to tell me don't go. I don't care. I just go. Mike Babcock said he was disappointed. You know, what happens if players like Ovechkin follow through and they defy the league and go play?
You're going to be called selfish either way. If you don't play for your nation, you're selfish. If you don't play for your NHL team, you're being selfish there too. So the players cannot win in this situation. Ovechkin, by the way, is a big enough star. No one's going to tell him what to do. So he will, in fact, go. But you've also noticed, too, I recall you and I talking about this, that what, 60% of Canadians?
Yes, listen to this. This was an interesting poll of fans in the U.S. and Canada. 62% of Canadians disapprove of this decision.
To not go.
20% of Americans.
That is not at all surprising. As a rule, globally, The rest of the world is far more into international competitions than America is. The United States were the least international of all the sporting cultures. Football is played only here. Baseball is played essentially only here.
The World Series.
The World Series. Thank you, Toronto. Windsor International Airport, I give you.
Okay.
So we are far more domestic in our tastes than the rest of the world is. So the rest of the world is dying to see this. The World Cup is a far bigger deal than any professional league, but not true in hockey and other sports.
Of course, considering Canada won gold in 3 of the last 5 Olympics, you can see why they.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they're back in their game. They're playing international hockey now. And plus, international hockey right now has never been better. Mm-hmm. It's the only sport out there that our six countries, Finland, Sweden, Russia, Czech Republic, U.S. and Canada, any one of those six can win it any year. And no other sport can claim that, but there it goes.
And we know that Bettman floated an idea. Hey, how about we play the Winter Olympic hockey game in the summertime so we don't mess up the NHL schedule?
Yeah, don't mess up the NHL schedule. What about the Olympic schedule? E.g., let's see, Winter Olympics. I'm thinking no.
Got to talk about college hockey, and beginning with the word from the University of Michigan about Red Berenson.
Red is stepping down after a glorious career, an amazing career, I would say, on and off the ice. I think a very tough decision for him. It took a while to decide it. He and Ward Manuel, the AD at Michigan, talked about this, and I think it's probably the best decision for Red Berenson and for the program.
Why is it good for the program?
Because it's hard to keep telling recruits that I may or may not be here your sophomore, junior, or senior year. Mm-hmm. And they've been telling recruits this now for 6 or 7 years. And that starts to erode your recruiting base over time. Furthermore, it leaves the assistant coaches, Brian Wiseman and Billy Powers, always in flux. There are good candidates out there. Mel Pearson at Michigan Tech will be a very obvious candidate and might well already have the job. So I think it's probably best for everybody involved. But hats off to Red Berenson on an unbelievable run. Best story I like about this team, 96-98, they won 2 national titles. 4 players from those teams all graduated from the University of Michigan Medical School. They had a 90-something percent graduation rate. That's how you do it.
That is pretty great. Speaking of faces that won't be around, from the word from East Lansing, this is a couple weeks ago, but Tom Anastos stepping down as the MSU hockey coach.
Very different story there. Tom Anastos, great guy by all accounts, very good for hockey in the region and a lot of big contributor there. Not good for Michigan State hockey. He had no experience coaching at the college level, and it showed, and they just weren't very good. Now, Michigan State's got a very strong coaching tree. It should not be hard to get a guy who drinks the green and white Kool-Aid to come on back.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, filmmaker Ken Burns joins us to talk about his latest work, The Vietnam War.
As someone who thought he knew about Vietnam, I realized almost early on, 10 years ago, I knew nothing. I've been working on this for more than a decade.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From the arrival of U.S. support troops in 1961 to the fall of Saigon, April 30th, 1975, the Vietnam War remains as one of the most painful chapters in our history.
I think the Vietnam War drove a stake right into the heart of America. Unfortunately, we've never moved really far away from that, and we never recovered.
That is from the latest work from Ken Burns, The Vietnam War. It's a 10-part, 18-hour documentary film series from Burns and co-director Lynn Novick, airing this coming September on PBS. Ken Burns will be in Ann Arbor this Wednesday, April 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Michigan Theater. He will preview and discuss the Vietnam War. He's with us now, and it is always a pleasure to say, Ken Burns, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be back on. Thank you, Cindy.
You say this is your most ambitious project to date. How so, Ken?
Well, it's hard to say. A lot of these are, you know, you never know whether your first film, which was only an hour long, called Brooklyn Bridge, isn't the toughest, or the Civil War, the first multi-parted thing, or Jazz, which is so technical. But there's something about the Vietnam story which is so difficult to get a hold of. It was as the sample of just one of the people offering an opinion in our film. There are many other opinions that coexist. You get a sense that this was a watershed moment for the United States. And I sort of believe that we caught some virus back then, a kind of virus of disunion and separatism that we experience today. The disease has only gotten worse. And our thought is that if we could go back and unpack what really happened, benefit from everything we've learned in the subsequent decades since the end of it, since that retreat in April of 75 off the rooftops of Saigon, whether we might be able to help us today understand a little bit. It's almost as if the film is the vaccine that helps you get over the disease. But, you know, our involvement goes well before those advisors in 61. We were sending advisors in the mid-50s and Truman and even just at the last days of the Roosevelt administration in 45 was dealing with the Viet Minh and the Vietnam question. And it even goes back before that with Vietnamese approaching President Wilson at the end of World War I trying to get better terms and hoping that the United States will support their independence move. It's just a fascinating story. It's like a complex novel with lots of different characters. You'll meet over 100 people, most of them you've never heard of. You'll get to know Truman and Eisenhower and Kennedy, particularly Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon, in ways that I don't think ever have before.
I think about your earlier work, taking us into the heart of the Civil War, which, of course, lasted from 1861 to 1865, and then World War II for America that went from December 41 to August 45. So between 4 and 5 years of real fighting. And here we're talking about this war, long, long years of war, and you're bringing us the story at a time that our nation has been fighting in the Middle East, you know, going back to 2001. Do you think these protracted wars affect our country differently than those 4 and 5 year huge conflicts?
Of course they do. And I think Vietnam is, you know, one of those things that it doesn't really have to do anything with how long it is, but the kind of war it is. The Civil War ended slavery and united the country. World War II, obviously, the most important event in world history, you know, ended militarism and fascism and did what it did. But you struggle to find in Vietnam and the recent wars the kind of redeeming value. It's more shadowy. It's more asymmetrical. We're not entirely sure at home whether we're for it or against it. The decisions that are made are based more on domestic political considerations than on the kind of larger geopolitical truths that an attack on Pearl Harbor or an invasion of Normandy or the Battle of Gettysburg might represent. And so I think that we're in a vague, you know, area of gray with the contemporary wars, and the Vietnam seems to be the first of those for us, and it's therefore hugely instructive. Now, it's really important to understand that my job is just to tell the story. My job is just to be the umpire, to call balls and strikes, to allow many different points of view to coexist within the same program, that unlike cable TV, we're not about scoring points or adhering to some political point of view, but to make that happen in a thoughtful and, I hope, deeply emotional way. So my advice to anyone who's watching it is, first, you have my profound thanks for dedicating time to this, but watch with somebody that you love and watch with an open mind, because as someone who thought he knew about Vietnam, I realized almost early on, 10 years ago, I knew nothing. I've been working on this for more than a decade, and that there is so much to understand about this war that we've never understood, and that we can benefit from all that we've learned over the last 45 years of not just scholarship, but talking to veterans and finding out what they did and talking to folks involved in policy and finding out what they did and being able to interview, you know, the opposing side, the Viet Cong guerrillas and the North Vietnamese soldiers, and also not neglecting, which we seem to always do, the South Vietnamese perspective, the civilians and the diplomats and the government workers and the soldiers there, who we tended to dismiss and say that they didn't really fight bravely, when in fact we've got a scene that will prove exactly the opposite.
Well, I think about the fact that unlike you know, World War II and the Civil War, you are telling a story of something that you remember. You lived through this. You grew up partly in Ann Arbor. You were at Pioneer High School. And at the time of the Vietnam War, as we all know, Ann Arbor was a hotbed of anti-war activities, some of them peaceful and some of them not. So I'm wondering, as you put this together, how did you frame that in the context of incidents like the June 69 bombing of the ROTC building on the U of M campus? How did that shape your understanding of the war?
Well, you know, it's funny. Now I don't recognize the person who thought arrogantly that he knew everything about it. The first teach-in about the Vietnam War occurred in Ann Arbor in March of 65. It started with professors in the anthropology department. My father was a professor in the anthropology department, but my mom was dying of cancer. She died the next month. I was 11 years old. There's very little. I then, you know, as you said, went through high school there and watched that all unfold, and I sort of came in with the cocky swagger of someone who would go, oh, yeah, I get this, and then almost, I don't really remember what I knew now because it was all the more complicated by what was happening. And when you then charge yourself, as a filmmaker must, with representing diverse points of view that you may not agree with personally, but who cares about that? That's not... I don't care. I'm an umpire. You know, I may be secretly rooting for the Tigers, but I've still got to call you out and the game over and the other team wins. So, you know, it's funny. My molecules have been completely rearranged by the process of working on this film in very good ways.
And your co-director, Lynn Novick, says we as a country are ready to have a conversation about the war. Why is that? Why are we ready?
Well, I hope we're ready. I think that, you know, whatever happened back then caused the divisions that we experience today, and I don't need to go into them, and we're not addressing any of the contemporary problems except, you know, obliquely, as the gentleman that you cited. It was an incredibly heroic Army man who we interviewed. Phil Joya is his name. And other people who had opposite views, that the Vietnam War actually brought out the best in us because it was the first time ever a sort of civilian population had essentially changed its opinion and got a government out of a war based on that kind of thing. So there's lots of different points of view that are expressed in that. But you want to be able to say that how we are right now is untenable. And as for someone who wrote, who made a film about the Civil War, it's hugely important that we not go back there again. So the question is, what can Vietnam teach us about how we are right now? And I think, as Lynn was trying to say, it's immense. It's limitless in our possibilities if we're willing to stop and look. If we just want to retreat to our own self-serving news source, then, you know, this will be a very controversial film, but only among the people who don't watch it. You know,
yes.
We live in a culture where people you feel no problem about reviewing books they've never read and don't plan to read, or reviewing films they've never seen and don't plan to see. And that's a sad commentary on those divisions. But this is a controversial subject. It's not a controversial film if you watch it. And that's what I hope Americans will do. And maybe we can begin to not only unpack what happened, but we can begin to see that that neighbor, whose political sign I don't like, is me as well. And that, as we already know, in the event of emergency, we're the first people over there, regardless of what the political sign in their yard is. And that's super, super important. And when we get there, then we have a way of diffusing a lot of what makes this toxicity that we experience today so, you know, seemingly fatal.
Ken Burns' latest documentary, The Vietnam War, will be airing this September on PBS. But Ken will be back home in Ann Arbor this Wednesday at 7:30 for an event at the Michigan Theater, previewing the film, talking about his work. And you can get tickets by going to the Detroit Public Television website, dptv.org/Vietnam. You can get also details on future screenings that will be happening around Southeast Michigan between now and when it airs on PBS this September. Ken Burns, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
The chemistry of cannabis. Northern Michigan University is digging into that with a new degree program, a first-of-its-kind undergrad degree in medicinal plant chemistry. What might this mean to the cannabis industry, and what kinds of jobs might graduates be able to get? Mark Paulson is here with us now from Marquette. He's a professor and head of the Department of Chemistry at Northern Michigan University. Mark, welcome to The Next Idea.
It's good to chat with you today.
What made NMU decide, let's do this, let's offer this medicinal plant chemistry program and be the very first?
Well, I think a couple of things. Certainly within the chemistry department, we have a lot of interaction with health professionals and just people in the area and the community who are interested in the medicinal properties of a wide variety of plants. And so we know that there's a lot of interest in this area. Certainly in some parts of the country, commercial cannabis is becoming a very large industry, so there's a lot of sense that there's going to be growth in the industry. And many states, including Michigan, allow cannabis for medicinal use. And so there's that group of individuals as well who are interested in plant chemistry.
So what do students learn? What are some of the courses?
The program is a solid science base with chemistry and biology courses, so courses in plant physiology, in botany, courses in analytical chemistry in particular, because the need we see is for good quality control, good testing of products that either people are selling, particularly a commercial product, or if they're making preparations for themselves, they certainly want to have a good, consistent dosage of the bioactive ingredients and so forth.
What kinds of jobs would a student be able to look for once graduating from this program? What's it prepare them to do?
It's primarily focused on preparing them to work in the medicinal plant industry. And an entry-level position would certainly be in a quality control lab, perhaps, where they're testing extracts or preparations to make sure that, you know, there's a consistent preparation from day to day or week to week. One of the interesting things we think about the program is it also has an entrepreneurial track, because we recognize that some of our graduates will want to make their own careers by starting their own small businesses rather than going to work for a medium or large-sized company.
Mark, the issue of medical marijuana is such a legal maze. Does this degree program offer any instruction and guidance as to how to deal with the legalities of it?
One part of the program will be a weekly seminar that all the students will attend, where they'll have guest speakers as well as in-house faculty talking about many different aspects of medicinal plant industry. Certainly some of those presentations will be on aspects of medical marijuana, because it's a very complicated regulatory environment, and we would certainly want our students to recognize that going into this.
I dare say that is an understatement about a complicated regulatory environment. I'm wondering about getting people on board with this program, starting with university leadership. What was that like?
The university leadership has been very supportive. The feedback we've gotten in general from the community is quite supportive. As I said, there are many area physicians, health professionals of different sorts, who recognize that a wide range of medicinal plants are being used, sometimes with the recommendation of the physicians or other health professionals. Sometimes, of course, it's individuals deciding for themselves that it'll help with whatever their health goals are.
What about parental reaction?
Of course, it's been a mixed reaction. And for the parents who are concerned, we try and emphasize this is not focused solely or even necessarily primarily on cannabis. That what we're training students to do is work with a wide range of medicinal plants and their use in health regimens, and that there will be lots of employment opportunities and outside of cannabis, because there are lots and lots of perfectly legal medicinal plants that don't carry the cannabis baggage.
Speaking of cannabis, how do you go about getting cannabis for the students to study?
So we want to be very clear about this. In the current regulatory environment, no student is going to be growing or analyzing any cannabis, at least initially at Northern, because you have to get very specific DEA approval to use cannabis in any sort of research or class project, and it's very difficult to get that sort of approval. At the current time, universities would be expected to acquire their cannabis from a licensed by the DEA university grow site, and at the moment, there's only one of those in Mississippi, and so initially, at least, we don't foresee the students working with cannabis directly at all.
Just because I'm very bad at chemistry, how do they study cannabis without this cannabis there?
Well, what we're teaching them is the techniques on how you would analyze any plant sample. And so that plant sample could be any of the nutrients or herbal supplements in widespread use around the country. Or if they get a job appropriate for that, it could be cannabis as well.
Mark Paulson is the head of the chemistry department at Northern Michigan University, NMU, offering the only four-year undergraduate program of its kind in medicinal plant chemistry. Thank you so much for being a part of The Next Idea.
I'm glad to talk with you today.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, the harrowing tale of Detroiter Conrad Montgomery, tried and convicted for a crime that he did not commit.
You only realize it happens when it happens to you or someone close to you. I had no idea innocent people went to jail until I was the innocent person in jail.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our next guest was sentenced to 12 to 25 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. In December 2012, a man was robbed of cash and a cell phone and shot three times on Detroit's east side. The victim's son used an app and tracked his father's stolen phone to a cell phone store in Southfield. And that's where the store owner identified Detroiter Conrad Montgomery as the person who'd sold him the phone. Based on this connection, Montgomery was found guilty and sent to prison. Today, we continue our series Compensating for Lost Time as we meet people who are eligible for compensation by the state for being wrongfully convicted. Last month, after numerous failed attempts in previous legislatures, Michigan became the 32nd state to offer compensation to those who've been wrongfully convicted and then exonerated. They're now eligible for $50,000 for every year they served in prison, plus other support services. So that means, if approved, Conrad Montgomery stands to receive nearly $150,000. We spoke with Conrad recently at his attorney's office in Detroit about the effort to clear his name. Conrad, tell us about the chain of events that sent you to prison. What was the crime you were accused of?
I was accused of armed robbery and attempted murder. One day, police knocked on my door. I opened the door for them. My sister's boyfriend was wanted. So they had been there before, so I opened the door like, he's not here. I was about to take a shower, so my clothes were unbuttoned. Like, he's not here. So I had an attitude like, why do y'all keep coming here? He's never here. And then they show a picture of me like, we're looking for you. I'm like, well, come right in, but I don't know what you're looking for me for.
And there was something to do with a cell phone that you were supposedly were linked to this?
Yes. Me and a couple buddies of mine, we were buying used cell phones. We had guys who paid more than reasonable prices for them, so we were buying up all the cell phones. We made ads, you know, legit, but not, it's not legit, but it wasn't anything malicious. Mm-hmm. So I bought a guy a cell phone, and I got questioned about it a lot after the fact. Like, well, why didn't you know this phone was stolen? Well, from my perspective, everyone has a lock on their phone. The phone didn't have a lock. Sold the phone the next day, and a month later I got picked up. I had no idea what it was about. Nothing at all.
So here you are charged with these serious crimes. You're in jail, and then you're sitting in a courtroom in a trial. What was that like for you where you're saying, I don't even know what this is about?
I'm sitting in trial baffled, like, well, innocent people don't go to jail. That's my first thought. Like, well, they're going to figure this out. Somebody's going to come question me, and I'm going to straighten this out for them. But that never happened. I waited and waited and waited. And even big, I wrote everyone. I wrote the judge. I wrote the prosecutor. I wrote the victim. Come see me. I still want to look him in the eye. I had nothing to do with your misfortune. I'm sorry you think it was me, but you got the wrong guy. You only realize it happens when it happens to you or someone close to you. I had no idea innocent people went to jail until I was the innocent person in jail.
I know from what I read that there was actually your own self-harm proved you weren't anywhere near where the crime is, but that was overlooked.
It was said that maybe I could have did. I was such a clever guy with cell phones. You know, imagination stuff, if you ask me. You know, I had kind of knew something about it. I knew a lot of guys got convicted on it on First 48 and things like that. I know the police used it. So I'm like, well, if they use it to catch guys, they can use it to to exonerate people also. So, you know, I never wavered from the truth. I told them everything. And if they would have looked into the stuff properly, everything I said was corroborated by the cell phone evidence. Everything. Every person I told them to talk to, where I bought the phone from, you know, the victim's phone pinged in the area near the girl who I bought the phone's house. Mm. When the prosecutor said I had already had the phone within 24 hours of the crime, so to speak, I didn't even have the phone. And, of course, I could explain why the guy I sold it to said I sold it to him, because I sold him cell phones every day. He was confused on which one I sold him that day.
Take me to the moment when you heard the word guilty and the moment when you were sentenced.
Guilty was like this to me. My heart dropped. My head flew back. I can't believe this shit. Are you serious? But I'm a dedicated person. I knew it. I knew I wasn't going to stay in prison. I knew a lot of guys when I went there. Everybody was working out, doing whatever they were doing. I was getting little, not eating, but I read. And I pleaded to every organization, oh, you're convicted, we can't help you. Oh, you're convicted, we can't help you. Oh, you're convicted, we can't help you. And I would never stop. I'm writing everybody, every advocate program. I won't stop. There's no way in hell I'm going to give up. I got two kids to get back home to. And they were 3 and 5 when I left. And now, you know, our relationships are tarnished.
How so?
Well, my daughter, she thinks I show favoritism to my son, but he attaches more to me. But before I left, like, she never left daddy's side. She was daddy's little girl. Now she's, daddy, I need money. You don't need to do nothing. Just give me the money for it. Mm-hmm. And I don't like it, but they did that. They ruined a man's life for not listening. The police and the prosecutors say they do a thorough investigation. Well, I thought a thorough investigation was investigating both sides. Mm-hmm. They did a biased investigation in my case. They botched it. And a lot of people say, well, who do you blame? I blame everybody. I blame the judge. I blame my defense attorney. I blame the prosecutor. I blame the victim. I wrote everyone. I tried and tried and tried. While I was locked up, they asked me, like, well, you can't write the victim. I'm in jail. What the hell y'all gonna do to me? I'm gonna write whoever I want to write. From my perspective, I was just trying to get to the source. Like, well, the judge is not working, okay? My lawyer's not listening, okay? Prosecutor's not listening. I'm going to go straight to the source. I'm going to go to this man. Mm-hmm. I wrote him, tell him, well, it's like bulletproof thick glass when you come see me. I can't touch you. Mm-hmm. I just want to look you in your eyes and tell you this. Like, you got the wrong guy. Like, let's knock this out like men. Let's one-on-one, me and you. You don't have to hide behind the prosecutor. I don't have to hide behind anything because I didn't do it. So when the truth's on your side, you just want to blurt it out. You want to yell. But then when no one's listening, you're like, what the hell?
Conrad, what was your sentence? How many years were you sentenced to?
12 to 25 years in prison.
The idea of 12 to 25 years in prison for something you knew you didn't do must have been just undescribable.
Initially, it was heart-wrenching. Like, it's over with. Your life is through. Your kids are going to be grown. What are you going to do? But I was like, no, this ain't going to work for me. I'm not doing this time. I gave it a year, though. Like, the process is long. Don't even expect quickness. Don't even expect anything fast. It takes forever.
When did the door open, and who opened the door to you being exonerated?
Again, I was in prison, and I was banking on the cell phone evidence. Like, I didn't have this guy's phone. They got to see that I didn't have his phone when they kept saying, like, they used this phrase in my trial. He had the phone within 24 hours of the crime, ladies and gentlemen. I remember this rang in my head over and over and over again. Like, he keeps saying that. I didn't have this phone. I didn't have it. So I'm like, well, if I can prove that I didn't have this phone, like he said it, I should be good. I should go home. So I dug in deep. A lot of guys are in there convicted using cell phone evidence. Guys were letting me see their stuff, and I was just looking over it, and I was writing experts. And a guy named Scott Ross from California sent me some information that was so vital. It gave me, like, the blueprint on how to read cell phone evidence. So from there, all I was looking for is information. I need this. I had every member of my family. Get this paperwork. I need this. I need you to do this. All I needed was stuff done. So, like I said, I was reading everybody's cell phone analysis reports, mm-hmm. and there was no expert in my case. So I'm finally getting to the bottom of this stuff, and I'm reading, like, well, wow, they read this wrong. They read that wrong. Mm-hmm. And then, like, once I can really read it, I'm like, everything I said, this cell phone is following it. So I had an attorney, and I'm geeked. Like, look. Yeah, we need an expert. Let's get to this. And the guy tells me, well, I don't think that's going to be helpful. And I asked them, who the hell asked you what you think? I said, just do it. I asked you to do it. Just do it. So we went back and forth about this for maybe a month. He's like, I don't think I'm the lawyer you need. I said, you're right. I don't think so either. And by the blessing of God, I got Michael Waldo and Malika Ramsey Heath. Well, Malika led it up, but they were great. They listened. That's all you ask. Listen and help.
So with their help, it did finally come together. And all the work that you did. And you were out April of 2016.
Yes.
And exonerated July of 2016. Take us to that moment when you walked out of prison. How long had you spent totally in prison?
A little bit under 3 years altogether.
So here you are walking out after losing the better part of 3 years of your life behind bars, knowing that this was wrongfully convicted. It was a mistake. So you lost years of your life and earning power and time with your children. And what did you get? What were you given to help you pick up your life as a free person again?
You know, when I first walked out, I wasn't free just yet. I still was bound by this case. They were still going to try me. But like sitting in prison, all you can do is think. I thought everything through. Like, I knew what they were going to do. I'm like, they're going to try to charge me again. How do I get around this? I know they're going to want to put me on tether and restrict my liberty. Like a curfew. What am I on curfew for? A bond is to ensure that you come to trial, not to restrict your liberties. I should be able to move as a citizen. So I looked statutes up and talked to my lawyer about that before I got out. Look, I don't want to be bound to the house when I get out. This is what happened. Like, I had a paralegal, or not a paralegal, but the guys who help you, like, that work at the law library. So I'm like, well, my decision's coming back soon. Look it up. I'm in my cell. I'm in level 4, so I'm locked down 20 hours a day. Look my case up while you're at work. So he comes back 2 hours later and slides my case under my door. I'm like, I know he didn't slide me no denial under the door. He wouldn't have printed it out. You don't waste money in prison. So I knew right there, like, okay. So I read it. I'll go to the back page first. Reverse and remand it. I said, okay, now I get to reading it. And I get one single tear out and tell my bunk, be like, I told you, I'm going home. I've been telling guys that for the longest. All the guys know I walk around with all legal work every day. Like, if anybody's going home, it's Conrad. When I did get out, I was like, okay, now here comes the next step. The next step was the curfew. Step after that was a new trial. How are you going to get around this?
You broke it down piece by piece by educating yourself, and you finally had lawyers that listened to you and believed in you. So finally, it comes. You are exonerated. You're out from under this. And I stop and I think that in Michigan, parolees get help with housing and medical care and job placement. But here, people like you exonerated after you spent years in prison unjustly. What did you get?
Initially, I got nothing. Once the exoneration came down, it was good luck. The prosecutor told me good luck. But again, like, I was torn. Like, I knew I was how to get out of the trial situation. My thing was to set the prosecution up to make it look malicious. Really, truthfully, that was my whole point. How can I make them look malicious? Okay, we can present them all the cell phone evidence that corroborates my testimony. Then I could present them with polygraphs that I've passed. So I told Gary, you want to take a polygraph? Absolutely. I have absolutely nothing to hide in this matter. Took one. It provoked them to give me another one. Of course, I passed that one. And then me, I don't trust the system. When I took the polygraph of them, I recorded it. And I wasn't supposed to, but I did. Then God told me you passed. I'm like, Gabby told me don't tell nobody, but I think I could tell somebody now. So once they told me I was a free man, they told me good luck. And I was like, no, this ain't all I get. There's no way. I'm like, why? I'm like, it's not my fault. I went to prison. Well, the prosecution, I said, no, someone has to be held accountable for this injustice. I didn't say, oh, send me to prison. I told you I didn't do it. If you would have listened, I don't care who you blaming on. Because, like, I've seen several civil lawyers, and they tell me, well, you really don't have a case. And that's irritating. Like, are you serious? Even on your side, like, the people who's supposed to help you, it's still the blame falls on you. Like, well, it's your fault. How is it my fault? I told you where I was at. It's not my fault.
I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Conrad. Are you angry?
I don't know what I am, because I'm like, my skin is crawling right now thinking about it. Like, it's just I got a evil, a hate in me that I try to control. I'm vindictive. Like, I'm real cautious about what I do now. I keep all my receipts everywhere I go. I make sure, like, okay, I'm on camera here. They won't get me like this again. And that's crazy. You got to think like that. And now I'm like, well, if somebody wants to know where I'm at, I'm definitely going to have some type of proof. I might, now was that Snapchat. I Snapchat everything, everywhere I'm at. Because they don't want to listen. If you're not on camera, you're hit.
What has been the hardest thing for you about rebuilding and reclaiming your life as a free man?
Relationships, personal relationships. Like my two older sisters, we haven't spoke since, I think, April of 2012. Because, like, I had bonded out. And the bond was ridiculous. I think it was like $15,000. I put down half. I had made a $500 payment when I got out. And my sisters didn't realize, like, if you don't pay this, I have to pay it. But I was going to pay it. They were like, well, we don't want that responsibility. And they never told me this. So I just go to court. And they're like, well, we're revoking your bond. So I go back to prison. And that killed our relationship. And my kid's mother got a new guy. They live together. You know, relationships were torn. You know, I mean, I missed my kids to death. I mean, I still took real good care of them while I was gone. That's the only thing I could do. They used to ask me, like, Daddy, you still got all the money? How you buy me this while you in jail? I'm like, well, I tried. I don't take for me. I took for them. Like, anything I needed, like, that commissary could wait. I'd rather my daughter have. What's the American Dial?
What's your personal goal for, let's say, the next 5 or 10 years? Where do you want to take yourself? Where do you want to see yourself?
I want to blossom. I want to be great. Really, I really want to speak out and really I still want to talk to this guy. I still want to this day. It's been what, 4 years? I still want to, like, and I want to tell him, you owe me too. Lawyer fees, all this, bonds. You don't get none of this back. The $50,000 is a nice start, but it's not enough.
People listening to this might say, you know, the victim didn't do that to you. The system might have. But do you feel like the victim kind of deserves some of the blame?
In my case, because I reached out to him. The man wants to speak to you face to face. He wrote you several letters. Mm-hmm. Stop hiding. You said I did it. Look me in the eye. Let's talk this out. Mm-hmm. It's not. People say, well, $50,000, this should go off of what they make. You don't know what a person can make. What they take from you is your potential. Mm-hmm. You could have hit the lottery. You don't know. You were gone. You were restricted from anything. You don't know what a person could have did. You could have got a better job. You don't know. That's what the payment is for. For your ability to grow. Your loss. It's not just because, oh, you had a job making $50, $60, $10 a day. It don't matter what you were making. It's the opportunity you lost. You lost so many opportunities being locked up for something you didn't do. Prison is hard for guys who did it. So imagine someone who didn't do it. It's extremely hard. It's extremely, extremely hard. Level 4 is a harsh place. Like, these guys are, like, my first day in prison, I seen a guy get stabbed, and I didn't know what to think. I'm like, are you serious? I didn't even know he had gangs. It was all so new to me. This wasn't my life. So I was shocked, like, whoa, this is crazy. But I adapt.
I can tell. We wish you luck. We do wish you luck, Conrad, as you reclaim this new life and put what happened behind you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next week, we conclude our series, Compensating for Lost Time, as we meet Thomas and Raymond Hires of Flat Rock. The brothers each served 25 years in prison for a murder they did not commit.
It's an out-of-body experience, especially for an innocent man to be sentenced to natural life in the state penitentiary without the possibility of parole.
That's next Monday in our series looking at exonerated Michiganders. And I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening today.